Good evening, everybody. How are we? I hope we're doing all okay. I didn't want to do Shabtai Tzvi directly, only because it's wading into very, very deep waters. I mean, listen, all of Jewish history is deep waters, but I think it's deeper than most. But that being said, I can go through characters for whom, or individuals and religious figures for whom Shabtai Tzvi, as a person, was influential, and also were very much involved in that whole episode. So we spoke about last week about the Taz, about how Rav David Siegel, the Taz, was very much involved in that towards the end of his life. There is the ambiguity, or ambivalence, shall I say, as to whether he ended up dying a follower of Shabtai Tzvi or not. Very, very much unclear. But that being said, no one can doubt that Shabtai Tzvi had a massive effect on the history of the Jewish people. There are a lot of local people related to Shabtai Tzvi and to that issue. And the ones I'm going to be dealing with are mostly Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, known fondly in halachic literature as the Chacham Tzvi, and also a little bit of Rav Moshe Chagiz. But in order to do that, we have to know some of the basics of the what's come to be called in Jewish history literature the Sabbatian movement. So let's start with his birth. Shabtai Tzvi is born 1626, 9th of Av. Was he really born on the 9th of Av? Ich weiß nicht. Right? That's how you say it?
Sounds good for the
Messiah. All right. So who knows? Why is this important? The Gemara says that Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. So whether he made this up or not, who knows? In 1648, that's where the first recorded claims of him being the Messiah, in Smyrna, in Turkey, where he was born and raised, in a Sephardic community there. This is an important moment. Why is it an important moment? Because, A, 1648, we all know what's happening. Tach v'tat, right? You have the Khmelnytsky raids in Eastern Europe. You have refugees from those raids ending up in Turkey. Remember, we spoke already about how the Turkish community, the German community, the Moravian community, even the Amsterdam community, all picked up refugees from Tach v'tat. Not only that, but the Turkey community needs to be remembered for goodness for the large sums of money that they raised in order to ransom Jews who were captured in the wake of that, in the 1650s even. So Zichronam Zachor Latov because of that. In 1648, he's going around claiming to be the Messiah. The records have that he was, as Gershon Shalom pointed out, probably suffering from some sort of bipolar disorder. Because people who knew him described him as moments being ecstatic and wonderful, etc., going on, and then at other moments him being downtrodden and depressed and almost suicidal. So probably he was suffering from some sort of chemical imbalance. But he's going around telling everyone he's the Messiah. So he is banished from Smyrna after they can't deal with it anymore. And he goes around Greece and Turkey for the rest of that time. At one point, he describes he actually marries a Torah. Unclear what was really going on. He did have a couple of failed marriages, which we know for a fact that he never consummated. You know, we know a lot about this guy.
I know that, just him.
He told people. Okay. 1658, he ends up in Constantinople, again, claiming to be the Messiah. 1662, via Cairo, ends up in Jerusalem. He marries a woman named Sarah, who is herself has her own history. She is orphaned at a very young age because of the Khmelnytsky raids. She ends up living, being raised with a Christian family. Unclear whether she may or may not have been a prostitute. But this was part of his experience, and she becomes kind of his partner there in creating the Messianic era. What really takes him to the next level is another young man from Israel, a man by the name of Nathan of Gaza. Nathan of Gaza adds to the lore of Shabtai Tzvi by declaring himself to be a prophet. And not only that, in his prophecies he has seen that Shabtai Tzvi is in fact a descendant of David HaMelech and is the Messiah here to redeem Israel. And he sends letters to the exile declaring that the Messiah has come. And this leads to a great deal of excitement. Why is it leading to excitement? You have a very downtrodden community. You have a community that feels broken. Remember, the apple of the Jewish world, the height of the Jewish world is the Ukrainian-Polish community, which has been devastated by the pogroms of 1648 and 1649. It's in the process of rebuilding. You have we'll get to why this happens. All right. 1665, he returns to Turkey and begins doing strange and forbidden practices. He would make the bracha of Matir Asurim and allow certain prohibitions to be allowable. He would have, at one point, 150 people around him begin prophesying around him. Again, very odd stuff going on. A lot of this stuff is in Zoharic literature. You know, in the Zohar, it talks about how in the Messianic era, you know, many of the halachos that we have today won't apply. So this stuff is going on there until finally he is placed in jail by the Sultan, who seems like he's really doing the bidding of part of the Jewish community that was really uncomfortable with all this was going on, especially since it seems Shabtai Tzvi declares before him that he is in fact the Messiah and will one day lead all of the world. In jail, he actually sets up what was called Migdal Oz. He sets up his own court in jail with some very complicit jailers, and people come to visit him there, and there's all this stuff continuing to go on in jail, until finally the Sultan can't take it anymore, and Shabtai Tzvi is forcibly converted to Islam. This is before Nehemiah HaKohen, who is sent from the Polish community to check this guy out, and Rabbi Nehemiah HaKohen comes to the conclusion that he is in fact a false Messiah, and this leads to a whole domino effect of major devastation. Why was it major devastation? Because people got caught up in this messianic fervor. Many people believe that he was the Messiah, and all these Sabbatean sects kind of emerge in, certainly in Turkey, but in Poland, in Amsterdam, in Italy, in England. All over in the various Jewish communities, you have sects that are declaring Shabtai Tzvi to be the Messiah. And all of this seems to be going on to the point where in 1670, the Council of Four Lands is forced to excommunicate all those who are followers of Shabtai Tzvi. In 1676, Shabtai Tzvi dies in isolation. What's fascinating is it continues. 50, 60 years later, Jacob Frank is going to merge in Poland and declare himself to be the reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi, and he's going to have a number of followers. But also, it seems like there are all these Sabbateans who continue even after he converted to Islam and even after he has died. People who continue to follow his teachings. And seem to be embracing the belief of Shabtai Tzvi, to the point where, just to give you some other things, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo, the Vilna Gaon was was violently opposed to those who would recite, I don't know how violently, he was opposed to those who would recite Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. So, you know, you can make the argument, is it a hefsek in the brachos, you know, all these other things. But one reason was because as part of the Sabbatian service, you would declare Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo as part of it. So that's kind of one of the interesting. There are all these other, you know, certain psukim of Tehillim that were placed up over the Aron Kodesh, were somehow hidden codes for Sabbateans. But there are all these hidden movements going on, and some majors, just to give you, you know, some of the people, you know, so we're going to talk about Nehemiah Chayun, who is outed as a Sabbatean. But Rav Yonason Eibeshitz, was accused by Rav Yaakov Emden of being a Sabbatean. The Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, is accused by Rav Moshe Chagiz and others of being a Sabbatean. This is not some stam thing. This was a movement that really overtook the world. And the question is, what was the appeal of Sabbateanism? Why were people so into this? You know, fine, okay, you have a false Messiah, and now he's dead. Let's move on. You know, clearly we were wrong. Listen, we're on tape here. We gotta be careful what we say. So, what was the appeal? What was the appeal of Sabbateanism? So, number one is, in the wake of tragedy, people are always looking for something to hold on to. You know, the community that had reached a point of one of the great heights of Jewish history, whether in Poland or in Spain or in other places, of wealth, of influence, of comfort, of all those things. So all of a sudden, you know, you have this massive tragedy of the Cossack Rebellion. You have the 30 Years' War going on in Western Europe. You have the revolution and the Protestant Revolution and the Counter Revolution. You know, these weren't good times to be living in if you were Jewish, because, you know, the Protestants hate you for one reason, the Catholics hate you for another reason, the Cossacks hate you for a third reason, and then the 30 Years' War, no one knows what the heck is going on there, but, you know, you seem to be the victim of that one also. So, you know, life stinks for you. And then all of a sudden this guy is saying all this stuff is going on, these wars, these reformations, these crazy things are going on. Why? Because it's all part of some messianic plan. Throw into that the fact that the Zohar seems to predict 1648 as the beginning of the Messianic era. So all of a sudden, you have the perfect storm of what's going on in this time. Yeah.
The 30 Years' War between Catholics and Protestants ended in 1648.
Correct. Meaning, the good times, you know. You know, I read a whole bunch on the 30 Years' War, and all I discovered were that there's, I think, hundreds of opinions over what they were actually fighting about. Okay? But all I know is they fought for 30 years. It was like one of those Helm stories, that they couldn't remember what they were fighting about. That's a, you know, all right. So that's number one, is what was the appeal of Sabbateanism. Number two is mysticism and spirituality, right? You have halachic Judaism. You have a Judaism that's focused on the Talmud, on those type of studies. For the average, regular guy from Yanumsvel, this was not. And then someone is appealing to your soul, speaking to your heart, you know, capturing you up. Apparently there were these, you know, spiritual orgies that people would take it. You know, this was exciting. You were caught up in a movement. You know, that in and of itself can be very, very stimulating and inviting to people. Another reading is the demiurge. One of the basics, or at least part of the basics, of Shabtai Tzvi's appeal or his statement was his acceptance of Lurianic Kabbalah and a lot of the basics of Zohar Kabbalah, which Zohar Kabbalah will speak. You know, so if you're on the more rationalistic lines, in more symbolic terms of Shechina, you know, of a personal God, you know, of a spherotic realm and of a separations and of something you could take will you and of the Shechina suffering and all those things, you could take it to the next level of the notion of a demiurge, you know, of some sort of lower God that stemmed from a higher God. Why was this, something that would be exciting to people? The Christians hate us, man. Right? They hate us. Why? Because we believe in one God. they believe in the Trinity, in the in the notion of some sort of demiurge. I don't get the 3-1 thing totally, but that's what they believe in. So this is, you know, in terms of assimilation, you know, we can't argue with the notion of assimilating, of making Judaism, you know, more comfortable with the Protestant, Calvinist, Catholic world in which they're living. You know, we could see very much why that would that would be appealing. And number four is what the antinomian nature, antinomian, the rejection or transcendence of halacha that often went along with Sabbateanism, that was appealing to people who thought Judaism was too imposing. Listen, this isn't, you know, some, you know, grand, you know, mystical type of thing. You know, in the end of the day, you know, I think Rav Elchanan Wasserman once said it about the Enlightenment movement. He says, you know, people say, what about the real philosophical problems? And he would say, maybe I'm paraphrasing to a certain extent, he says, I didn't know drinking in bars and sleeping with women was a philosophical issue. He says, what do I want? I have someone who tells me the religion I can keep is not as intensive and as intense as I might think it is. You know, though that's what he's saying. You know, you don't have to do as much. You know, life's going to get easier for you. You know, all these opportunities to do these things. These were kind of the attractiveness of Sabbateanism. What was its relationship to Lurianic Kabbalah? So we did Lurianic Kabbalah already. I don't know, must have been months ago, but we definitely did it. But the basic, the upshot of Lurianic Kabbalah is the Ein Sof light, the infinite light, was poured into the world, the physical world, and it could not handle the splendor and the power of the Ein Sof light, and therefore it caused the moment of what we call Shvirat HaKilim, the breaking of the vessels, and causing the light to spread out into millions and millions of parts or sparks, which are now hidden amidst the klipot, amidst these terrible things. Right? That's what it was. It basically created also redemptive spirit. A redemptive spirit, which we said, you know, when we discussed Menashe ben Yisrael, we said it was in the air. In those times, you have this kind of prophetic spirit, you have the Protestant movement, you know, just to give you the messianic spirit of the time. So Paradise, John Milton writes Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained in this time, right? Because again, he's thinking in redemptive messianic terms of the second coming and things like that. So it would make sense that Jews would be thinking like that also and embracing the Lurianic Kabbalah. So Gershon Shalom, who, you know, for years was the historian of Jewish mysticism, he claims that it's all Lurianic Kabbalah. He claims there's Lurianic Kabbalah in the air, everyone's reading the Ari, talking about the Shvirat HaKelim. Why are there these orgies of sin going on, you know, associated with Shabtai Tzvi? That's because they have to go down into the klipot, into the evil, and they have to redeem the sparks from the evil. And the only way you can get the sparks out of the evil is by doing and involving yourself in the evil itself. You know, that's one of the perspectives that's given. You know, the notion of this redemptive kind of building that's going on, Shalom tracks it all the way back to where? To 1492, to the Spanish Inquisition. You know, that's when the Ari starts speaking, and that explodes. Moshe Idel is not as convinced, and as are others, later scholars, are not as convinced as Shalom was, that it was all Lurianic Kabbalah, this redemptive spirit. A lot of it might have had to do with, you know, some of the other issues that we're speaking about. And it's probably more complex than that, and just to say, what's going on here is whatever it is, it's the perfect storm of everything going on in those terms. And you know, people were looking for something, and people were are going to be looking for something for a while. And what's indicative of it is that one or two generations later, you're going to have Hasidut, you're going to have the Musar movement, you're going to have all these kind of alternative movements to kind of the normative halachic movement that's being created or being kind of built at this time by, you know, the commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, etc. Okay, so there's a lot going on here in those terms. Into this world is born the Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, a very, very important figure in halachic literature an extraordinarily complex guy in a lot of ways, but also extraordinarily influential. One thing you can see just by opening up a book of his responsa is he's writing tshuvot to everyone. There are Sephardim, Ashkenazim, Western European, Eastern Europeans, Polish, you know, Moravians, you know, Germans. They're all asking questions to the Chacham Tzvi, and some of the questions are wild. And we'll get into some of it. So who was the Chacham Tzvi? So number one is he's born to a family that survives the Cossack invasion. In 1655, he ends up in Ofen, Hungary. Again, he's heading west in order to escape the Polish invasions. He's born into a very distinguished rabbinic family, and from that rabbinic family, he is sent, of all places, to Salonika to study. Why is this? Salonika is in Greece. Why is he sent there? It's a Sephardic community. But they like the yeshiva. Ein adam lo meid ela b'makom sheli bo chafetz. This is where he wanted to learn. And sure enough, he comes back, not Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, but Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi was, in fact, not his last name, but since he was hanging out with the Sephardim, what they call him, Ashkenazi. So he became the Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi. Okay, and that's how he was known forever and ever. He returns to Ofen, where he stays for a while learning, but unfortunately his wife and daughter are killed in a pogrom. He just manages to escape himself. And he ultimately, you know, finds himself back on his feet again, becoming actually the chacham, or the rabbi, of a Sephardic community in Sarajevo. In 1689, he remarries to the daughter of Meshulam Zalman Newmark Morels, who is the rabbi of Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, which are three communities which were closely associated with one another, what they are known to in the ancient literature as Kiilot Ahu, Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, and he becomes he moves into there and he studies there under his father-in-law and under his tutelage. His father-in-law is obviously a very prestigious position for a very prestigious community and also a diverse community. In 1707, his father-in-law dies, and the rabbinate is split between two movements. There are those who want the Chacham Tzvi to take over for his father-in-law, and there are others who are promoting the candidacy of Rav Moshe Rothenberg. And in the long Jewish tradition that goes back to Solomon, they decide to split the baby in half. What do? Not split the communities in half, but they say, listen, 6 months a year, the Chacham Tzvi is the rabbi, and 6 months a year, Rav Moshe Rothenberg is the rabbi. All right. Oh, so where do they start arguing? Is it that the Chacham Tzvi is the rabbi on Rosh Hashanah and Rav Moshe Rothenberg is the rabbi on Pesach, and they argue over chametz and how we should sell the chametz, or whether you can be mater kitnios or not? What are they arguing about? So it all comes down to a chicken, right? And the Chacham Tzvi has three tshuvos, three full responsa, defending the opinion that he took on this chicken. What was the case, right? We all know about that back in the olden days. But what would you do? You would bring your chicken to the Rav. The Rav would check your chicken, and you would baskin. Is it kosher? Is it not kosher? Zeu. So the Chacham Tzvi tells us about the case. Simen Ayin Dalid, right? 74 of Shelos or Tshuvos, the Chacham Tzvi says this one. Maise bariba achat shepatcha beten tarnegolet. Right, so a certain woman who opened up the kishka, the stomach of her chicken, lohotzi bnei meyeha b'tzvat ha'shulchan, right on the corner of the table. Right, she's pulling out the kishkas of her chulin of her chicken in order to prepare it. V'chatul echad omed lamata etzla omed umitzapel la'echol mimashi yipol arza. What's going on? There's a cat waiting. What? For lunch, right? Because whatever is going to fall off the table, the cat's going to eat good. Okay? The Amra Riba, Shalom Matzah Leiva Tarnagolet. The Ima, Baalata Tarnagolet, Amra Shema or Krove Levadai, Hushla Chalev La'aret, V'achlo Achatu. How made Sham? So what happens? She looks inside, she cannot find the heart of the chicken heart. So we all know that if a chicken is missing its heart, God forbid, it's a trefa, right? You can't eat the chicken. Okay? And she thinks, what must have happened? Since it was at the edge of the table, it must have fallen out. And before I even noticed it fell out, the cat must have eaten the chicken. Okay? It must have eaten the chicken heart. The woman or the riva who was cutting it open, she says, "I don't remember throwing it out." The maid says, "I don't remember throwing out the heart." And the cat looks 100% healthy. So meaning if the cat did eat a heart can't be the healthiest part of a chicken to eat, the head is shmeina v'tova, right? So this is the issue that's going on here. And so, what is the Chacham Tzvi paskin? So you go to the end of the tshuva, which I brought here, it's at the beginning of the next page. He says, Ein ze kedai la'asor v'ze la'meir v'makom acher sh'minyodan, Ein tzarech l'choze v'adavar parshut sh'atarnegolet muteret. What does he say after going through all the issues? Chazaka, no chazaka, rov, no rov. He comes to the conclusion that what? The tarnagolet is mutaret. It's a kosher chicken. All hell breaks loose over what? Over a chicken. And the Chacham Tzvi, who is not known for, shall we say, his political savvy. In fact, he was known for being quite brunt and blunt and in a lot of ways. He's not known for any of these things. The Chacham Tzvi will not, you know, play politics well here. And because he didn't have many friends on the board or whatever it is, and sure enough, paskin the wrong way, Rav Moshe Rothenberg disagreed, and he leaves rather than deal with the issues. And of course, there's another job waiting for him, what seems to be the perfect position for an individual like the Chacham Tzvi. So if you all remember, back when we discussed Rabbi Menashe Ben Yisrael, we pointed out that the community in Amsterdam was mostly Sephardic former Maranos, right? Conversos, whatever you want to call them. New Jews were some of them. A very odd community. Nonetheless, one that felt a lot of fealty and connection to the rest of the Jewish world. And eventually, even though most of the time they were much happier sending money, eventually a Jewish community forms of refugees from Germany and from the 30 Years' War forms in Amsterdam. Again, the economic opportunities in Amsterdam, because what's being formed in the 17th century, right? The New World is being settled in the 17th century, and who is at the forefront of this? The Dutch East India Company, and the Dutch West India Company is, of course, at the forefront of this, and so the Jews move there for the economic opportunity. So you have a Sephardic community there, and you have an Ashkenazic community there. And that Ashkenazic community hires HaChacham Tzvi Ashkenazi to be their rabbi. The rabbi of the Sephardic community is a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Solomon Ailon, who again, is there tension between them? Is there not tension between them? Unclear. But, you know, we all know how religious politics works. We can imagine that between a Sephardic and Ashkenazi community, both of whom probably ended up being fairly affluent, we can imagine that there was some tension going on between them. Comes along an individual by the name of Nehemiah Chayun, who is a mystic, and who, if you knew him back in the old world, back in the land of Israel, you would have known him to be a fairly prolific Sabbatian. But he comes to Amsterdam and is hiding that fact and is peddling his spiritual works under the title of mysticism and Zohar mysticism, etc. We know also that this is a fairly, shall we say, modern, progressive, perhaps a bit assimilated Amsterdam community. And of course, you know, the Chacham Tzvi looks around and sees the danger of what it is that's going on here. Showing up also in the town is another very interesting character by the name of Rabbi Moshe Chagiz. Rabbi Moshe Chagiz, also from the land of Israel, and he says, you know, he's like Inspector Javert, I know that guy. That guy is a Sabbatian. And so the pamphlets are brought before a tribunal upon which the Chacham Tzvi sat, and the Chacham Tzvi is convinced that Chayun is a Sabbatian and goes to war over it. He is going to sniff this guy out. He is going to punish him. He is going to, you know, destroy this man who is a Sabbatian. And in truth, he has, at the beginning at least, a decent following, although, as was his wont, he did not foster all the best relationships with some of the gvirim within the community. And so he goes after Chayun, outs him as a Sabbatian, wants him chased out of the community, wants him put in Cherem. He reaches out to Rabbi Solomon Ailon to join him in this project. Ailon originally agrees and then balks at the end and then rejects it. So was it that Ailon was a closet Sabbatian himself? Probably not. Or was it a, what more likely, is old world versus new world politics? What does that mean? You have this ancient Amsterdam community, a community which is progressive, a community which isn't necessarily being as traditional as otherwise, and then you have an extraordinarily traditionalist rabbi in Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi, at least in his in a lot of his practice. Couple that with a Sephardic rabbi of Rav Moshe Chagiz, who is similarly traditionalist. And this is something Dr. Elishava Karbach, one of my old teachers, points out in her book on Rabbi Moshe Chagiz, which unfortunately I did not get to read all of it, but I read a number of reviews of it just to hopefully grasp it. But she pointed out that a lot of this Sabbatian hunting wasn't just, you know, trying to weed out, you know, false messiahs and followers of a of an incorrect philosophy, but it was an effort to preserve traditionalism of act. You know, it was very much about, you know, this is the way halacha is acted. This is the way halacha is preserved, and those type of statements. So those type of experiences are very, very much important. And so you have this conflict of old world versus new world. You have Rabbi Ailon assuming that, you know, that all of a sudden Chacham Tzvi is a carpetbagger, you know, he's an interloper into the Sephardic community, he doesn't understand it, doesn't know what's going on, and sure enough, after enough, even though he had his supporters and many people who believed that Chayun was a Sabbatian, and as we said, he probably was a Sabbatian, he resigns in 1714 and travels to London and to Emden, and ultimately ends up as the rabbi of the very distinguished community of Lemberg, where he passes away only after a few months serving as the rabbi. What's interesting, just as kind of an aside here, is eventually we'll get to the Rav Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz argument. Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz will become the rabbi of Ahu. Also, he was one of the people who disagreed with, what's it called, with the Chacham Tzvi's position on the chicken. And he supported Rabbi Moshe Rothenberg. And he gives out these little medallions called kameyas, which go back 2,000 years, to heal people. And Rav Yaakov Emden is going to see one of Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz's kameyas, and he's going to decide that Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz is also a closet Sabbatian. Rav Yaakov Emden's father was none other than the Chacham Tzvi. Oh, so you have here everything coming together, but that's just to whet your appetite about some of the future, some of those things that's going on in the future. An interesting tshuva. I'll just do two really interesting tshuvos of the Chacham Tzvi, and then I'll let you all go. So number one is he's sent a question by the community in Anglei Taira in England, because they are worried about their rabbi, Rabbi David Nieto. They said, we love him very much, but he said something which we believe to be very controversial. What did he say? Let's go back. We go back to the 1640s and 1650s. There's a man in the Amsterdam Jewish community, maybe or maybe not a student of Menashe ben Yisrael, by the name of Benedict Spinoza. Benedict Spinoza had one of his major chiddushes in the realm of all philosophy. He says, God is nature. Right? Gewalt, they debate, they did, da-da, da-da. 1656, Spinoza is excommunicated. Okay? This is part of the, you know, the history of the Amsterdam community. So now Chacham Tzvi gets a question from the board members, the nobility, the Parnassim of this community. He says, we need you to paskin on a question. Our rabbi, Rabbi David Nieto, the rabbi of Kilat Kadosh Sharei Shamayim, Darash B'Beit HaKneset, Darash Zeh. So he says, well, we're going to translate it into Hebrew for you. He says, what did he say? He says, Amarti by Yeshiva, Shehashem Yitbarach Vehateva, Vehateva, Vehashem Yitbarach Hakol Echad. What does he say? That nature and God and nature are all one. Omer ani shekach amarti v'ani mekaimo, and Rav David Nieto says, that's what I said, and I believe in it. I'm standing behind what I said. V'achrichenu me'achar shedavid ha-melech mekaimo. He says, and who do I have hold like me? Not Benedictus Spinoza, but David HaMelech, right? You can't get bigger rabbi than David HaMelech. You have to get Moshe to be the bigger than David HaMelech. Right? David HaMelech, Mizmor Kuf Mem Zayin, Tehillim 147. What does it say? HaMechaseh Shamayim Ba'avim. It says God covers the sky in clouds. Mechin La'aretz Matar. Right? He prepares the rain for the land. He says, V'atzmiach Harim Chatzir. What am I doing? He causes the plants to grow. God is nature. So the community in England wants to know, okay, should we fire him? Should we hire? Like, what should we do here? What position do you think the Chacham Tzvi takes? Says the Shelo to Tshuvot B'Chacham Tzvi. Says, what do you mean? Says, of course God is nature. Says, that's part of what we believe. Don't we say every day, Amashiv Aruach Morid Agashim, V'tein Talu Matar L'Vracha? Right? Who gives all these things? What makes the world move? Who makes nature go? God is nature. Oh, so we see here, there's a nuance difference between Spinoza's position and Rav David Nieto and the Chachav Tzvi's position. The nuanced position is, Spinoza thought God was the laws of nature which are bound, and therefore all of life is predestined. Right? You know, it's preordained. And he believed that God is the mover and shaker behind nature. That being said, he speaks in very philosophical terms, and, you know, there's a boldness to what he's saying. Nevertheless, it's interesting. It's interesting that the Chacham Tzvi ends up in this position of all positions, because where is the Chacham Tzvi end up being rabbi? In Spinoza's old stomping grounds. Granted, this tshuva is written before. It says it's sent to him while he's still in Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. While he signs it. Yubitzedek po Altoona, right? So he writes it in Altoona. So he's still not yet the rabbi in Amsterdam. But that being said, he takes a position here of great boldness. Other people would like him, because the Chacham Tzvi was of the position that anyone visiting the land of Israel should keep only one day of Yontif in Israel. That was one of his famous opinions for that. But other one more is Siman Tzadi Gimel, which has to be the oddest tshuva you'll ever read in your entire life. What is the responsa? So he says, Mistapati, he says, I have a suffix. What's my suffix? He says, Adam notzar al yadei sefer yetzira. A man has been created by use of the mystical work sefer yetzira. Ka'ota shamru b'sanhedrin, Rava bag Ravra. Just like they said, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that Rava created a man. V'cheinu he'idu al zikeni hagon morinu arav Eliyahu, av basin dekilas chelm. Says, that's what they said about my grandfather. He actually created a golem in Chelem, back there. So he says, Mimit Stari Fla Sara. He says, can you count them for a minion or not? This is the kasha he's dealing with. Litzvarim Hatzrichin Asara, for those things that require a minion, Kidgon Kaddish or Kedusha. For Kaddish and Kedusha, can you count them for a minion? Mi Amrinan Kevan Dechtim Nikta. V'nit kadashti b'toch b'nei Yisrael, lo mitzdarif. Right? Do we say that since it says, I shall be sanctified amongst the Israelites, he's not included? Or maybe since you, when you raise someone in your house, when you raise an orphan in your house, it's like you gave birth to them. So maybe, therefore, since we're raising the golem, therefore he can count as he can count for the minyan. All right, and he goes through the various shitas. Like I said, the oddest tshuva you'll ever read, in your life. But nonetheless, it's interesting, And the fact that he had a tradition that his grandfather created a golem is also itself interesting. Also, he mentions nothing of the Maharal, we'll just say, and he's not so far removed from the Maharal. If the Maharal had created a golem, this would be the time to mention it also. I remember back in Prague, the Maharal never counted the golem before for a minyan, like all these things, like there's all these opportunities to say that. That being said, the Chacham Tzvi, like I said, in terms of halachic works, his tshuvos definitely carry a lot of weight. Like I said, a lot of his blunt style prevented him from having like comfortable rabbinic career. And that being said, it's something he handed over to his son. His son was similarly blunt in his perspectives of Yaakov Emden, and he instigated, shall I say, one of the greatest fights in Jewish history, the greatest spiritual fights in Jewish history. But we'll get to that when we get to that. But that is the Chacham Tzvi, and again, he was one of these Sabbatian hunters, which are going around now, who are seeking to weed out this kat, this sect from among them, who is following Shabtai Tzvi. I mean, one of the things that, I guess I'll leave us all to think about, which is, I guess just in broader terms, is, once Shabtai Tzvi is dead, like, what's everybody so into? Like, I don't get it. Like, what do you gain from it? You're living in the Jewish community. You're not going to gain much by being, a Sabbatian in the Christian community. Like, I don't know what the end game is to be a Sabbatean. Just stop to believe in a demiurge I guess the opportunity to be more flexible with a halachic commitment is itself a bit of a viable or interesting option, but other than that, I don't see the appeal or the what's going on up there. But yeah,
the mental attitude, once you set a mental attitude of redemption, you expect it to happen no matter what happens around you. So right. You stick with it because you don't have the choice.
Right.
You're troubled anyway. You might as well stick with what might come back.
Right. All right. Okay.
Why are they still doing it? All right. Okay.
All right.
So that's the same mistake, right. My opinion.
All right. That is that.
And did he lose the debate on the when they got the...
What? He didn't. He didn't lose the debate.
Why do people follow? Pick up on it.
What? Some people do. It's hotly debated. No debates are ever lost. They're only.
Yeah, it's hotly debated, but it seems to be the way minority opinion.
Yeah, it was a minority opinion. Doesn't mean it was a bad opinion. Yeah.
So how widespread was this Sabbateanism? Was it all through Europe?
I mean, if you read Gershon Shalom, it's like. It's behind every movement to this day. You know, the Donme in Turkey to this day are the Donme. They're pseudo Muslims. They're who followed Shabtai Tzvi. To this day, yeah. But it's hard to say how widespread it was. But there are Sabbateans all over Europe. There were other
Shlomo Molfo in this day.
Yeah.
The same period.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it was if you wanted to be a false messiah, this was the era you want to live in. Yeah.
Can we go back to the cat for a second? What was the argument here that the cat jumped up and grabbed it out of the chicken?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
But I don't understand. Why it was a question of the chicken doesn't have a heart? A chicken can't live without a heart.
Well, so you're not going to get. She didn't shech the chicken. She got a dead chicken on her plate.
Okay.
She goes to the market, buys a dead chicken.
Okay.
Opens up the dead chicken. There's no heart in it. Could it be?
No.
So how?
Okay. How can a chicken live without a heart?
Didn't live. Right. Died. Lost the heart.
Right. No. So that. So now you're follower of the Chacham Tzvi. That's what he said. How could a chicken live without a heart?
Right.
Yeah.
She didn't have a heart.
Well.
The cat didn't hear.
All right. No, but then you have the fat cat. Why isn't the cat sick? The cat ate a heart, you know? It's like it's complicated things there. Yeah. All right. All right.